From the Land de Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Out of the office, so no update of the commodity markets. Instead, today we'll hear from the Tuesday, March 7th event at the All Day Ag Outlook, where Bruce Sherrick, the director of the TIAA Center for Farmland Research, discussed the price of farmland going forward.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Okay, so there's this fundamental disconnect that we want to kind of explore. Farmland markets have been on a two-year bull market run that we haven't seen perhaps ever. In the last 2 years, Indiana alone, big part of the productive area of Indiana alone is 40% up, Illinois over 40%, and Iowa even more than that. 2 years, in just 2 years, Class A, top quality farmland, just massive increase in prices. In Illinois, we do a little book every year. We have about 100 professionals in Illinois. Some of you may be in the room, in fact, to help with this. We track every single farmland sale and then have a professional look at it and say, was this a representative sale or not? What were the conditions under it? How was it leased? Who bought it? Was it an investor, farmland neighbor, so on? And then projected cash rental rates, last year's rental rates, next year's rental rates, and so on. And we're releasing that in 2 weeks in Illinois. And for the first time, I'll give you a couple of previews. For the first time, Class A, middle of Illinois Class A farmland. We use SPIs instead of CSRs, but think of it as like 220, 225 corn ground. Topped 17,000 an acre average across all sales that were considered legitimate, arm's length, not too farmers fighting necessarily for the 40 acres between them and so on. And one of the questions that I get a lot is, how does that make sense? How would you explain a $17,000 on something that's running for $400 and generating a sub-3 cap rate? And it turns out that I think markets are exactly right. I'm going to come out and defend that number. If you were here last year, you remember me being very optimistic, and I'm very glad. I had a 50% chance of being right, so I'm pretty happy. But last year, I was pretty optimistic on farmland values because it looked to me like all the forces were lining up in a way that was pretty hard to overcome with other random events. And we'll talk about those in a couple minutes. But what would we do to explain the last 2 years and put that in context for a longer time period? And Jonathan and Nick did a really great job identifying some of the anomalies, I guess, over the last couple of years that accrued to farmland owners. And we'll talk about the prospects of those looking forward too. And I like to talk about them as the usual suspects and the new players. So the eyes have it. So the I states, we always talk about Indiana, Illinois, and Iowa when we want to know about the farm economy health, in a sense, for corn and soybeans, since that's where we sit. And those have just been there's no historic context that I can look back at and go, well, it's because. It looks just like this. The explanations are this and that. In 2019, we did kind of clear out some of the excess soybean stocks with the floods in the upper Midwest. We had a series of payments from coronavirus and market facilitation payments, and we have a whole bunch of other payments that would not have been typical against history. But we had some other really big things happen that I think are really the wake behind the boat, pushing it forward and got us to where we are today. And we'll talk about those in just a minute. Well, incomes have been really, really high. Incomes have been high both because of these payments that came from non-traditional sources, but also because the thesis for demand expansion of calories around the world is coming true. We're really good at forecasting populations. China's population has essentially peaked. India was overtaken it, maybe has overtaken it already. It's a little hard to know exactly the date on that. The armpit of Africa, if you're looking at it, the left-hand side around the curve is growing rapidly, both in terms of demand and longevity. Health of the planet is getting better. And as people come out of poverty, they eat higher quality diets. So if I gave everybody an extra dollar in this room, and some of you heard me say this before, it doesn't change what we eat. If you give two-thirds of the world another dollar, they change what they eat. So as the world is getting richer, we're eating more high-quality proteins, and to eat some pork, for example, you have to eat a calorie of from a pig, you have to grow 9 calories of corn. So the demand expansion is a really important thing, and that's a really critical issue for the thesis for long-term production of farmland. Where you can grow stuff, we're in the middle of it right here. We heard about Brazil and Argentina, and Joanna's been a fantastic addition to the FarmDoc team. Tremendous to see the world's production centers, but here's a really cool thing. The soils aren't moving. We know where they are, and they're not going to be any other places we can grow stuff. We already know where they all are. And we're going to keep growing and shipping further and further away to get the world's demand for calories met. Number two, inflation. Anybody worried about inflation? My goodness. So, you know, the joke I like is that the Fed is funding another $2 trillion study to find out if printing money causes inflation. Well, it's pretty understandable why. When we went through the period of time where we said everybody can't go to work because we have a health concern that's widespread, but we're going to try to make up for that and bridge people through. If we printed too much or we printed too little money, that will be debated for decades. But what we did do is print a lot of money. The amount of money in the money supply has gone up by something like 40% in just under 2 years. Now, that has to go somewhere. And so the fixed factors of production, 200 and some years ago, we discovered what is the item in any productive society that captures the basic rents. And the most fixed factors of production include farmland. Also, what's the very definition of inflation? It's the nominal price change in widely consumed commodities or goods. Can you think of a more widely consumed commodity or good than commodities and goods produced by agriculture? And so what we find out through time, and there's a slide later in this deck, and again, if you would like these like in full size, send me an email and I'll send them to you. The correlation between farmland returns and inflation has been one of the great constants through at least my 30 years as an economist. It's not completely obvious why until you kind of peel back the layers and figure out how it happens. But the price levels and the quantities of things we produce get kind of absorbed by the market demand. And Malthus will always be wrong because we allow prices to change. So what we've done with commodity prices and what we've done with productivity in agriculture has been nothing short of astounding. You hear Secretary Vilsack give his comments about we're growing twice as much as we did 30 years ago with only two-thirds as many inputs, or some numbers kind of like that. Those aren't precise quote, but it's the fact that we've been growing more and more on the same land, maintaining soil health to some degree, in varying degrees, and doing so with less damage to the future environment. That means we're growing more with something whose value has to reflect the relative value that that contributes to the demand for all those products. So that's one of the reasons why farmland values keep going up. So it's not just the cash rent, it's the growth in the cash rent through time, the growth in the income it can produce, and the appreciation in value, which registers that through time. Next item. Interest rates. Anybody worried about interest rates? Well, I have a little different take than Bob did. I think that's absolutely right. But I'll give you some of this as a personal story as well. In the last couple of years, I bought all the farmland I can, but I can't buy much because I'm just a teacher. But I put as much fixed rate debt behind it as I could. Now, what do I think about my 3.9% mortgages? I think they're pretty good. It makes it hard for me to sell those parcels. It puts us locked in. But the value of that was actually a giant contributor, in a sense, to my balance sheet, because the value of that debt when interest rates went up means that the value of that debt to me as a liability went way down. So this registers more broadly in the economy through our residential debt than anything else, because we have a lot of long-term fixed rate debt. And so if you have a 4% mortgage on your house, and you'd like to move out to a nicer, bigger house, you go, I don't really want to give up my 4% mortgage to get a 7% mortgage. But the economic value of having that reduction in the future value of your liabilities also accrues to agriculture. A lot of the debt, if you look at the balance sheet of U.S. agriculture, this is an amazing year. We just topped $4 trillion with a T, asset values in agriculture in the U.S. $4 trillion. It's an amazing number, absolutely amazing number. And there's no debt, 13%. It's not no debt, but it's a very low amount of debt. So people have different amounts of leverage. There are people in the room that have 70% debt. There are people in the room who have no debt. There are a lot of people in the room who have something in between. But the fraction of debt as a fraction of asset values is incredibly low. I've used this example before too, but if you took all the companies on the New York Stock Exchange and collapsed them onto a single balance sheet, it would have 66% debt. If you take all of the agricultural assets, collapse them onto a single balance sheet called U.S. agriculture, it's 13%. So it's a relatively low burden, even though changes in interest rates are very influential for a particular person's income. On operating notes, likewise, if suppose you have a $400 per acre operating line for 6 months, and the interest rate went up by 2%, that's the same as a bushel and a half of corn. So again, it's a big change in interest rates. The burden to that year's income is something that is case by case. And for folks who are like an institutional buyer who use debt to buy, kind of lock them out. For a buyer who is a cash buyer, it kind of gave them an advantage. Those intersected in the market in the last couple of years, along with some influences that brought more land to market. 2 years ago, we were worried about changes in the estate rules. That didn't come to pass, and we were also worried about changes in capital gains. So we started bringing land to market at a slightly higher pace. Again, I mentioned we get all of the transactions in Illinois. About 1.5 to 2% of land turns over per year at arm's length. That's a very small number. But when you go from 1.5% to 2%, as kind of happened, it looks like a 33% increase in the number of transactions, because it was. So it also, this thin market effect supports farmland values in a really important way, because you don't get a chance to buy the neighbor's farm all that many times in your lifetime. That very slow turnover is a really big deal. I talked a little bit about the international effect and rest of the world effects. I want to make a couple of semi-controversial comments. One of the questions about what we do with the production and distribution of food around the world has to do with trade. And over the last few years, we've entered into a lot of activities and we've built a lot of obstacles to trade. We've decided that we want to onboard our chip manufacturing, and we passed the CHIPS Act, and we want to do this. And in the long run, it's very counterproductive for both sides. This is not a U.S.-centric view, by the way. Whenever you can't trade, both sides lose. Now, in the U.S., we like buying 60-inch TVs for $350. And I'm not exaggerating. I just did that. If we want to build that TV in the U.S., it's going to be a $10,000 or $12,000 TV. Okay. So we also like to grow food in the U.S. If we consume only the food in the U.S., hamburgers are going to be really, really cheap, but you're not going to make any money growing food in the U.S. So the reliance on the ability to transport and trade will become ever increasingly important, because where people are living in the future and the population growth is actually fairly predictable. We know when we're going to cross 9 billion. We're going to pile up people where they are already. In the U.S., it's basically on the coasts. In Europe, it's pretty dense. China, India, and Pakistan are always going to represent a giant fraction of the world's population. Growing population in the corner of Africa, growing really rapidly. And the world's debate about the price of food is going to be settled in places and by people who are currently poor. So being able to ship to and take advantage of trade and comparative advantage where cost of labor and capital differ is actually good for both sides. We want to make sure, so again, controversial or not, onboarding and trying to, you know, the iPhones you all have, I've heard a report that 31 countries are involved in the manufacture of that, if you count all the elements where the parts come from, where the intellectual property exists and so on. Try to do that on one country, you can't. So paying attention to how that works going forward, to me, is one of the grand risks that we're facing right now. Figuring out how to do that in a smart way is a big deal. The next item that I want to talk about a little bit is carbon, climate, and conservation. We've heard about, only every single headline I read about agriculture has something to do with carbon or climate or conservation. And we've become numb to the debate in a way that we think that climate equals carbon and carbon equals conservation. And those translations are not that simple. Figuring out what share of the U.S., what share of the total carbon footprint is represented by agricultural activities. We hear numbers that go from 17 to 25 quite frequently, depending on how you count animal agriculture. But what I think is forgotten sometimes is the counterfactual. What fraction of the activity that creates carbon includes also consuming food, which is not one of the things we're willing or able to undo. So the counterfactuals have to be taken care of. But what's really important is that we've changed the tone of the debate. Agriculture is now viewed as one of the potential solutions, because the original solar collector, it turns out, is a plant. And so if you can keep things green longer, you have the potential to capture a bit more carbon, stored at least temporarily, in the same way that pumping out fossil fuels is just temporarily, you know, we temporarily stored dinosaurs and plants from a few billion years ago temporarily till we pump them out of the ground in the form of hydrocarbon fuels. So we have a chance to put a bit more carbon back into the ground, and that payment channel that is chasing that comes from two sources. One, a real demand for it. Two, companies that have gotten a bit over their skis in promising to do carbon smart or sustainable practices. Again, this is a study that's more than a year old now, so it may be updated. But the S&P 500 companies, 93 or 94% of them, have a published sustainability plan. Publicly traded companies, as you know, have to go through something called a proxy evaluation. Glass Lewis and ISS are the two evaluators, and one of the things you get a positive check mark on, or ESG, environment, social, governance, sustainable practices, or proving that you're doing things that are sensitive to your carbon footprint. Of those companies, many of them have explicit carbon plans, but what they would like to do is be able to check their box on their proxy service. And one of the cheapest ways to do that is to say, you know what, I'll pay you $20 if you go no-till. So those things are coming, and they're building, and they're building some pressure. I don't know how long they'll last, because the translation eventually of calculating what the actual carbon effect will have to follow. We'll eventually have to do the accounting for it. But we're really pushing federal policy in that direction as well. The IRA was mentioned. I have a couple of very cool graphs. There are a couple of fantastic studies. They're kind of a dense read, but a couple of studies on where you would locate wind and solar, if you could, to minimize the cost of installation. And it turns out that you can't just put solar out in the middle of deserts, because transmission is very expensive. You have to put solar somewhere at the happy medium between where people consume energy and where you can capture it from the sun. And so that optimization problem, if you will, lands over top of farmland quite a bit. Likewise with wind. You can't put up wind towers where there's no wind. And people don't like wind towers in their backyard, especially if you're on the coasts. And you know, the demand for wind and solar, there's a couple of really cool graphs in this partway through, is really coming and is going to be part of the transition to greener forms of energy. And we're going to get paid for it. And it lands over top of farmland. So again, if we were just to put some of those items together, the direct spending out of the Inflation Reduction Act, I'm kind of jumping around on my own slides here, could add about $500 billion of payments capitalized into the value of farmland over the next 10 years. So that's a positive that we didn't have before. The negatives include competition for production from the rest of the world. The negatives from a U.S. perspective, higher interest rates, lower growth rates. If we were going to do anything to take productivity changes out of agriculture, I don't see that on the horizon, but it could happen if we had regulation against GMOs, for example, and could no longer use Roundup Ready or something. Those kind of risks do exist. I think they're relatively minor at this point. Again, in the packet here, I have reference to a NCREIF. NCREIF is, I've been one of the luckiest guys in my career of anybody I actually know personally, landed on campus, and NCREIF was just looking for a place to begin to build a farmland indexing system. And I happened to be on the team that helped build that from scratch. First project I ever got at the U of I, with Dave Linz and Cheryl DeVeese. It's a great project. 33 years later now, it is the undeniable standard for measuring rates of return to farmland by institutional investors. About $16 billion in it, all accounted for on a single accounting system. So we keep track of how TIA and NCREIF and the Mormon Church and others do their accounting and standardize it so that nobody can, you know, claim a different return based on some accounting trick. And that's become really critical, but we can also parse it up and look at different parts of the country. The Pacific Northwest has done quite well. The Corn Belt has done fantastically well in the last year. And the last year, four quarter rolling rate of return in the Midwest is 27%. So why would you want to pay $17,000 for an asset that's generating 27%? Because markets are rational. So if you were to really be honest about it and compare it to other sources of return, compare it to other financials, the S&P has done a little worse over 30 years than farmland investments. How about that? Farmland investments have clearly outdone a fixed income and have a very high and positive correlation to inflation. So if you're worried about protecting your long-term wealth, farmland is likewise a really good investment. I know I'm about out of time. Todd, you want to switch to Q&A pretty soon too. But a couple other things that I think are scary, I've given you kind of the positive view again. And remember last year, if you were here, I was very, very positive. People were a little bit like, ah, that guy's nuts. He's predicting farmland. This year, I'm not nearly as rosy, but I'm also not saying we're looking at an impending crash at all. Won't surprise me if we have a little pullback. Won't surprise me if we have a little bit of a run-up. But I think markets are incredibly rational. The wild card in my mind is the Fed. The Fed has, since 2008, undertaken a series of behavioral responses to things in the economy that have never been done before. We just didn't have that experiment before. So we have started adding assets to the Fed's balance sheet in 2008. And you remember that experiment when the housing crisis began. If we didn't, we would have had a global meltdown, frankly, that could have just stopped markets forever. In retrospect, it looks like a great experiment. At the time, I was kind of throwing up my hands and saying, I have no idea even what they're doing. And the Fed's balance sheet exploded because we bought assets from banks that had too little capital, stored them on the Fed's balance sheet, and then put the banks back into business so they were not out of capital standards. Roll forward, the Fed's balance sheet exploded. We had this trillions of dollars on the Fed's balance sheet and that was starting to come back. And we think, the experiment was over. We did it one time. We'll never have to do that again. Never risk stopping the world again to respond to what was a temporary emergency. Coronavirus hits. And we decide to do the same thing again, but at an even greater scale. And this time, without actually having assets behind it. We didn't say, here's the price of a bond, what will you bid? I'll sell it to the public, buy it back, use the money to fund another program. We instead directly printed money from the Fed into the Fed's balance sheet, by the Treasury into the Fed's balance sheet, distributed it so there's no production on the backside of that. So it has to eventually become inflation. Unwinding that is actually a really big deal. We've never done it before. The Economist magazine published a study that said, unwinding a couple trillion dollars over 3 years is the same as a 50 basis point increase in the interest rates. Again, that's not insignificant because it means what the Fed is doing is not only changing overnight rates or the Fed funds rates, banks can deposit their excess money or borrow at that rate, but also affecting the stable economy and the stable interest rate in the rest of the economy by the possibility of liquidating the Fed's balance sheet. That's a terrifying thing to me. So if I were saying, what are the things that could make me wrong about asset values? It would be that, would be number one. However, what asset would I rather own at that point? Farmland. In the 80s, we had a farm crisis that was very isolated to the agricultural sector. This would be an economy-wide meltdown causing event. And in that case, I'd rather own farmland than anything else.
Bruce Sherrick is the director of the TIAA Center for Farmland Research on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois and the College of Aces. He spoke during the Tuesday, March 7, All Day Ag Outlook. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report.